It's Tuesday, May 9th. How long will this negotiation be? Well, how long does it take to say no? We start here. President Biden prepares to welcome Republicans for some debt ceiling brinksmanship.
The president is not going to negotiate on raising the debt ceiling.
Are both sides daring each other to plunge the economy into disarray? The shooter had a gun, a plan, and a swastika tattoo.
Despised women, which definitely comes forth in his writing as well.
A disturbingly familiar profile emerges in Texas. And he already revolutionized electronic devices. Now he's focusing on electricity itself.
Well, nuclear energy, if we do it right, will help us solve our climate goals.
Bill Gates prepares to build a nuclear power plant. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Imagine you've got a credit card that you share with your family members. Call it your family credit card. Together, you've accumulated a good credit score. You pay all your debts on time, everything's good. Sure, you have disagreements over who's spending money on what sometimes, but you would never just not pay the credit card bill. Well, one day, imagine a family member said, okay, these expenditures you've been making, they're irresponsible. When our next credit card bill comes, I'm not going to deal with it unless you promise you're going to cut your spending. And you go, wait, I see what you're saying. I personally think these expenditures are justified, but I can see why you'd want to negotiate this, but why would you threaten to not pay the credit card bill? Wouldn't that just ruin credit for everyone in this family? Your family member says, well, that's on you. What would you do next? Would you say, okay, fine, I'll negotiate my spending with you? Or would you say, go ahead, I dare you, ruin our credit. This is such a bad way to do business. I'd rather cost us extra money now than set this kind of precedent. That is what is happening with the debt ceiling right now. Republicans refusing to pay the nation's debts until certain demands are made, and President Biden refusing to negotiate, all with America's credit representing billions of dollars in economic risk hanging in the balance. Today, it's going to be a family meeting happening at our big White House, and the question seems to be less about will everyone agree than who's going to blink first. Let's go straight to ABC's White House correspondent Karen Travers. She's at the West Wing right now. Karen, what is this going to look like today?
A very tense family meeting, if you want to put it in those terms. This is going to be President Biden sitting down with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, he'll be there as well, Republican, and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. This is always interesting to see the managing of expectations going into a big meeting like this and the setting of terms after a meeting when who comes out and talks and how do you say how it went and who gets to the cameras first.
The sad part here is now the Democrats need to do their job. The president can no longer ignore by not negotiating.
If you're House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, you want to be in front of the microphone very quickly and say how it went and sort of dictate the next stage of this debate because the clock is ticking. We got a couple weeks until that X date from the Treasury Department where they say that the nation will hit the debt ceiling and the government could default on its debt.
Yeah, and so what's on the table then, Karen? Like if defaulting on the nation's debt could do everything from, you know, devastating financial markets to increasing borrowing costs to, like, it could even play into Social Security and veterans benefits. If all that is at risk, I mean, what would they be negotiating over?
So I can tell you what they're not going to negotiate. The White House says the president is not going to negotiate on raising the debt ceiling.
We're not a deadbeat nation. We pay our bills.
He has been firm on that for months. And the White House, even as recently as yesterday, Karine Jean-Pierre at her press briefing says that has not changed. He has not budged on that and he will not budge, even when he is sitting across the table from Kevin McCarthy.
They are manufacturing, House Republicans are manufacturing a crisis. They should get back to regular order, which is dealing with the debt limit as Congress must do.
So the question then is, what are they going to be talking about? And she continues to say, and we've heard this from the president, that he's there to remind them of the urgency of this moment, remind lawmakers of their responsibility to raise the debt limit, and then say, we can then have a conversation about cutting federal spending. So you've kind of have both sides coming in with very different positions about what the meeting is even like. Because if you're Kevin McCarthy, he says these two things have to be talked about together.
Wait, how do we have a meeting if, like, we're negotiating with the president if the president's not going to negotiate? Like, what's the point of being there for anyone?
Exactly. And I asked Corrine this last week. I said, okay, so if the president is not willing to negotiate on the debt ceiling, what is he actually coming to the table with? What are the mechanics of this meeting?
He's going to continue to make very clear that this is up to Congress to act when it comes to the debt ceiling.
So they're still in their corners. Like, the lines in the sand are so firmly drawn, neither side has budged a smidge at this point. It doesn't seem like they're going to be able to have a lot to talk about if neither side is willing to move from those very, very firm positions.
So, Karen, what are the pitfalls of those two political strategies then? Like, I imagine each side is thinking, we've got the upper hand here, the other team will blink first. Or are they thinking, like, this could blow up in our faces?
You and I have probably had many conversations like this over the years about government shutdowns and spending fights. And, you know, they go through those motions. And are they going to do a short-term extension? And is the government going to shut down? And sometimes it does. Most of the time it doesn't. But they figure out ways to get out of that. And few major impacts are felt from that, right? This is different because even as they are going back and forth and talking about what they will or will not negotiate and are trying to see which side blinks here, there is still that potential of a credit downgrade, that the government, the U.S., could have a credit downgrade by the credit agencies even without a default, even, you know.
Oh, where the credit agencies goes, you guys are so messed up, we're just going to downgrade you anyway. This is stupid.
Yes. And we've seen that happen before without a default happening. So, you know, as you get closer and closer to the edge here, as we get closer to that early June or mid-June time when the default could happen, there could be significant ramifications for the economy, even as the standoff continues. There's always this, oh, lawmakers will figure it out. They'll work on it. They'll get it done. There'll be some deal struck. There just doesn't seem like that optimism right now. The White House will say that, you know, they feel like they'll sort this out, but there's just no budging at this point.
Right, and they're thinking there's a public perception here that for a while the Republicans have been seen as you know, imperiling the nation needlessly, but now you're going to have pictures of the President Biden saying, I will not negotiate on this crucial, crucial thing. That has its own political risks. Karen Travers, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, he didn't keep his hatred secret, so how did he buy a gun out in the open? We go to Texas after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
Yesterday, we learned new details about the shooting that killed 8 people at an outlet mall in Texas, including some of the identities of those who were killed. Kyo Sung Cho and Cindy Cho were enjoying a day out with family before these shots rang out. Elio Kumana Rivas from Dallas was 32. Aswaria Tadikanda from McKinney, Texas was 26. Christian LaCour was working as a security guard at this mall. He was just 20 years old. But some of the victims were even younger, including Daniela Mendoza, who was in fourth grade, and her little sister Sophia. Their mother, Ilda, is now in critical condition. we're also learning more about the shooter and a disturbing profile that is actually becoming frightfully common. ABC's chief national correspondent Matt Gutman is in Allen, Texas. Matt, you've spoken with some of the people who witnessed this firsthand. And by the way, a warning of how horrific some of the details are here. But what have you gathered just about how this all played out?
One of the most brutal things about this shooting, Brad, is that it took a while for first responders to get there. And so 6 minutes before that hero officer arrived and neutralized the shooter. And then it was minutes later before paramedics and other first responders arrived. So the people who arrived on the scene who we talked to try to administer aid were there for minutes with people literally bleeding out.
I approached the woman who was conscious. She said, please work on my daughter. This woman had massive trauma, 5 to 6 gunshot wounds.
One of these men told me, Joshua Barnwell, that he held a little child in his arms as the life slipped out of her.
But I saw the massive amount of blood come out from her when I gave her a chest compression from her back. I knew she was gone.
And I know that it's very, very graphic, but he specifically wanted these images to be told because this is the destruction that a .223 caliber bullet does.
You're describing this in unbelievable detail.
It's important.
Is that because it's seared in your memory? Because
it'll never leave my memory, and it's important that the people out there realize the depth of the depravity that this went to. That these people that were literally, I had to cut shopping bags and purses off of them because all they were doing was shopping with their families.
The amount of blood that these people describe, the confined space in which these people were shot, defies imagination. And one of them describes something I've never heard before. She was there before first responders. Her name is Jeannie Ruppel.
So I was trying to console the husband, trying to get his attention, you know, so Josh could administer first aid to his family.
What was he saying? What was that?
He was saying, why is there not an ambulance here? Where the F is the ambulance? Where are they? My wife and my children are dying. He watched his youngest die.
Medics, paramedics started dry heaving and hyperventilating, and she watched one young police officer actually begin to throw up because of the carnage that they were seeing.
But to see these first responders act, you know, visibly shaken and crying and sick and trying to catch their breath and trying to understand what was going on, that will always be in my mind.
It's so horrifying for obviously the victims and the families and everyone involved. And then you learn about this gunman who apparently, like, there was a plan here and an ideology behind this. What do we know?
It seems so. The trove of social media posts he left behind, many, many hundreds of them, seemed to indicate that he had scouted out this location over a year in advance. On multiple occasions, he even took a screenshot of the peak hours of this outlet mall north of Dallas, Saturdays 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., and the shooting happened at about 3:30 on a Saturday afternoon when it was, in fact, teeming with people. He had talked about his guns. He had allegedly showed off these Nazi-style SS tattoos all over his body. So we understand, according to authorities, that this person had been thinking about this for quite some time and obviously went out and executed it in an extremely lethal way.
And it makes me think, like, I'm thinking of the shooting in Walmart in El Paso several years ago. You had a heavily armed man, far-right extremist. He specifically targeted Latinos. Here, you're describing what might have well been a heavily armed man, potentially far-right extremist, who is Latino, with Latino heritage. Are authorities giving us a sense of just how concerning this sort of profile is becoming?
They are, and they're saying that the two things are not necessarily mutually exclusive. You can be a white supremacist Latino, but there's also the incel aspect of this, which is very common in these mass shootings, and this person seemed to perfectly fit the bill in some of these social media posts. He does talk about his inability to be with a woman, and he blames it on women themselves. So not only was he purportedly, you know, neo-Nazi and white supremacist affiliated, but he also despised women, which definitely comes forth in his writing as well.
I'm wondering, Matt, then, if this creates more pressure on, like, he's still got a gun, right? He's still got an assault-style rifle. So I'm wondering if this creates any sort of momentum when it comes to gun control, particularly considering we saw a bill yesterday advance in the state house championed by some of the parents from Uvalde.
And that bill would essentially provide that people cannot buy assault weapons until they are above the age of 21.
Vote the Raise the Age bill out of committee.
Anybody who's 18 years old in the state of Texas, actually federally, can go out and buy a long gun. They hope to make that illegal, but that wouldn't have changed anything here. What actually would have made a difference are red flag laws. Now, this suspect, this shooter, was discharged from the Army in 2008 over mental health concerns. So there is a trail of mental illness. And the fact that there weren't any red flags, that nobody heard about this, is very, very concerning. In addition to that, we know that he built an arsenal. There are handguns and multiple long guns, including AK-47s, which have a larger, more lethal round as well. He didn't use that. But this is someone who obviously has been planning this for a long time and could, he really could have been on authorities' radars if the laws had been different.
All right, Matt Gutman there in Texas. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thanks, Brad.
When I think of Bill Gates, I imagine he's got a lot to say on coding, on machine learning, on tech, which he does. In fact, he recently spoke exclusively to our Rebecca Jarvis about it.
Are you scared?
We're all scared that a bad guy could grab it. Let's say the bad guys get ahead of the good guys. Then something like cyber attacks, you know, could be driven by an AI.
But he had actually invited Rebecca out to Wyoming to talk about something else, something that has less to do with the future of the internet and more to do with the future of everything else. And this is where big thinkers can go bigger than you were ever expecting. Bill Gates thinks he's ready to harness a new version of nuclear power that would have big ramifications for everyone and, in the near term, huge consequences for the people in Wyoming. Let's go to our chief business and technology correspondent now, Rebecca Jarvis. I mean, what is Bill Gates? I'm not picturing like the quarter zip sweater in Wyoming. What's he doing out there?
Well, Brad, what he's doing out there is working to build the next generation of nuclear energy. And one of the interesting aspects of the town of Kemmerer, Wyoming, where he's doing this, it's a town of about 2,400 people. They have a coal plant there now. That coal plant will be retiring in 2025. And the idea is the nuclear power plant, which they plan to build right up the street, will be able to employ many of those people who will lose jobs when the coal plant retires. Mm. Now, there's a bit of a gap right now between when the nuclear plant will come into existence, 2030, and when the coal plant will retire, 2025. But one of the key aspects here, Brad, is that so much of the time when it comes to new energy projects, green energy projects, they're being built in different locations than those who are losing jobs mm-hmm. as a result of what we think of as the sort of energy fuel sources of the past. And so it becomes very politically difficult to sell the notion of new energy, of new energy projects in areas that have been decimated by the fact that those fuel sources are no longer in use.
This is actually the place where the nuclear island will be located.
With the coal plant off in the distance.
So this town, I walked around, obviously the town, but we walked around the coal plant. We walked around the new location where the nuclear plant will go.
People would hear things about nuclear and you think of some of the past incidents that have happened around the world. Trevor Fowler's done a very good job coming in to show people how the natrium process differs and how it is much more inherently safe than that. So
I also spoke to a number of the people in the town and sat in the lunchroom of the coal plant and got to talk to employees, which was really eye-opening. I mean, obviously, it's a big deal to them to have Bill Gates there in the lunchroom.
Hey, Bill got to eat this burger. I think you guys are going to sit down for business.
But people were honest about the fact that they're sort of cautiously optimistic about all of this.
Well, and so how would this nuclear plant work? Because according to Gates, this sounds like it would be different from even your average nuclear power plant.
The difference is the technology. And when it comes to nuclear energy, some of the biggest issues are with the cooling source. So traditional nuclear energy relies on power to keep it cool. If you think back to, you know, the images of Chernobyl, you have the power going out and the water isn't able to cool off the reactor enough so that there's, you know, not this huge meltdown and the catastrophic damage. Bill Gates and his company TerraPower
have developed a new cooling source that doesn't require power in order to remain active.
And we have dramatically less waste, but every one of those areas you mentioned, there are valid concerns that TerraPower has to show that we've solved.
So the two key differences are the cooling source as well as the radioactive material, because radioactive material remains radioactive for thousands of years. You don't want to create a lot of it. This new nuclear energy of the future, based on what TerraPower has created, is going to create a much smaller amount of the radioactive waste.
Just by being designed with so much cooling capacity, which is this liquid metal that's below ground, nobody has to do anything. You know, nobody has to push a switch at the right time or, you know, why something in. It's inherently safe.
And the question of waste. And so his company has solved for those two key things. The big outstanding issue that still has to be sort of resolved is cost.
Today's plants are way too expensive. The economic challenge, you know, we just have to change. We've solved all the areas where there have been safety challenges.
This project, as of now, is about a $4 billion project. And typically when the U.S. builds a new generation reactor, it is completely funded by the government. In this case, it'll be 50% from the government, 50% from TerraPower, Bill Gates' company. And yet, even at that price point, in order for this to be a more mainstream, more widely adopted thing, that price has to go down.
Yeah. And Rebecca, I feel like we go in cycles with nuclear power, right? Where we go, wow, this is great because it doesn't produce carbon, and yet it can produce vast sums of nuclear waste. So I'm trying to figure out, like, is this something that environmentalists are excited about? Wow, we've harnessed new, you know, if Gates' ambitions are real, this is a game changer. Or is this just a return to something that we don't want occupying our land?
Well, given the amount of radioactive waste and the small amount here, there are many in the industry who are very excited. But obviously, this is an area that is not without critics.
They're not being designed to withstand the worst case accidents. They're only being built to withstand the most likely. If you do that, eventually you're going to hit a worst case.
I will say Bill Gates is not the only industry titan who's put a lot of money into nuclear, and they see it as sort of the one viable path truly forward.
Why are you so committed to nuclear energy?
Well, nuclear energy, if we do it right, will help us solve our climate goals.
One of the interesting things that Gates and I discussed is the time that it takes to build nuclear power plants. He started TerraPower in 2008. It's been 15 years. He still doesn't have a nuclear reactor. That's why you need community buy-in, which right. This is a community that is on board with the project. They actually chose Kemmerer, Wyoming, after looking at a handful of different locations. They're able now to, instead of building a physical reactor and then making adjustments or sort of figuring it out after the fact, they're doing a lot of this digitally so that they can look at through simulations, so they don't have to do as much building to understand what kind of radioactive material is this going to produce, how can you keep it as clean as possible, and also live up to those climate objectives.
Right. And you can see the ambition from somebody like Bill Gates saying, hey, we're going to need more energy in this country, not less. The demand is going to be to have it be cleaner energy that comes from the U.S. Now it's time to see if all that is up to snuff. All right. Rebecca Jarvis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, what's the newest black market smuggling ring? Well, here's a hint. It takes in loot by the foot. One last thing is next. And one last thing. How tempting are American sweets? Well, perhaps tempting enough to risk Israeli police. Recently, two different American couples were caught in Tel Aviv allegedly trying to smuggle in hundreds of fruit roll-ups. A recent video appeared to show airport security sifting through several suitcases stuffed with the things. The other couple was reportedly caught with more than 50 pounds worth, far over the weight limit for foreign foods. And this has been happening more and more often lately because of a TikTok trend.
It's Saturday night, and I'm going to have my sweet guilty pleasure. My fruit roll-ups.
It turns out the fruit roll-up is only half of this delicacy. Apparently, people are taking the fruit roll-ups and wrapping them around ice cream.
Cheers. You guys have to try this. 10 out of 10.
Which kind of makes sense, I guess. Like, what is the Japanese dessert mochi if not just ice cream wrapped in something sweet? But this DIY mochi has become such a thing in Israel that fruit roll-ups have been selling out. Stores have been jacking up prices. Customers have been turning to generic or health food versions. I decided to see what all the fuss is about.
Okay, so we've got our fruit roll-up. Let's unwrap it.
Apparently, vanilla is the go-to flavor of ice cream to pair these things with, but mango and strawberry are also favorites.
Mmm, crunches. Oh my God, that's good!
I was not ready for how good this was. What I hadn't counted on was that the cold ice cream freezes the fruit roll, creating a shell around it that snaps like this delightful, artificially sweetened creme brulee.
Wait, this is really good. I'm so embarrassed.
These have become so addictive that Israeli police have now confiscated more than 600 pounds of illicitly imported fruit roll-ups in recent months. And the National Health Ministry put out a statement warning about elevated sugar levels from this treat. And a lot has been made of American exports over the years. Dollars, weapons, the internet. But with this recipe on the loose, we've never seen jitters like this. I gotta tell you, I was like vibrating half an hour after having one of these. Like, it was very good, tasted good. I would really think twice about doing this to yourself. Hey, if you're enjoying the show, please hit us up with a 5-star rating and review. It really does help us out. I appreciate it. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.